This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and let's now check in with Ed Feigenbaum. He is the creator and the editor of the Indiana Gaming Insight and the Indiana Legislative Insight newsletters, which come out by Hanna News Service. He's based in Indianapolis, and Ed, he's going to talk today about gaming issues, and thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Chris. You know, we talked last week about doing this today. You know, I didn't know that my sweet mellifluous tones would be kind of muted here by the sinus infection, and I also didn't know that we'd have all this news to talk about with Illinois.
I tell you, you sound great, and we'll bull through the sinus issues. You know, begin at the beginning, as they say. Bring us up to date here, I guess, in particular of what impact we've been starting to see, I guess, out of what the General Assembly did this past session. I know that there were, among other things, of course, the casino license issue. That's gone on, I guess, in some cases to some public comment in places and some other action in others, especially up here in the region. And, of course, too, I know that we're getting close to doing something on sports gaming, we think. At least that's supposed to be the case, right?
Absolutely. And gosh, I guess I'm honored that you left all this for me instead of posing these questions to Senator Bohachek the other day. You know,
he did cover some of this as well. He didn't cover everything, but he did cover some of it, I know.
Yeah, well, he's got that blue chip casino in his district, you know, the one northern Indiana casino outside of Lake County. But I think the legislature did a real good job for the state of Indiana of trying to fulfill what it set out to do, and that was to take a good look at where we are today, understand the competitive environment around us, both in the surrounding states and in the national picture as well, you know, with the whole question of internet wagering and gambling and the changing demographic of people in general, much less just the gamblers. And they did a real good job of looking at where we are and where we've been and kind of ignoring that to a certain extent and saying, okay, where do we need to be in order to be best positioned as a state for, you know, the next wave, whether, you know, we want to get ahead of things or whether we want to be prepared to, you know, push back against Illinois or Ohio or Kentucky or Michigan, whatever, where do we need to be? And they did that. They ended up with the major piece of gaming legislation that allowed the move of the one casino from Gary to the off footprint inland location on theoretically I-80/94, and then that relinquished or dormant license could potentially be used for Vigo County, which everybody kind of refers to in an offhand manner as Terre Haute, which is west central Indiana, which would have theoretically, legislators were hoping, preempted the ability or the interest of the state of Illinois in opening a casino in Danville, Illinois, just as the strengthened Gary Casino and the ability of the Hammond and East Chicago casinos to receive, or the communities to receive so-called hold harmless payments to keep them whole for a few years as they prepared for the changed competitive environment from an inland Gary Casino, would have done things right by them.
Yeah.
And they made some other changes for the casinos as a whole that essentially bolstered the ability of the operators to continue to invest in the state of Indiana. There are some significant tax changes that will help them, both in terms of the wagering tax structure as well as the what we refer to as the free play tax deduction, what the casinos refer to as their deduction for complementary play.
Comps, I think, or something like that, I think is
that. Right. And that will change in a couple of years. And then, of course, we also went to live table games for the two casinos. So a little something for everybody around the state and for the casinos as a whole. We also passed a sports wagering package as part of that will include mobile wagering, which means, to the chagrin of the chairman of the House Committee on Public Policy from Auburn, that, you know, his next door neighbor in Auburn can go and pull out, you know, his or her cell phone or iPad and wager on the Colts or the Bears or whatever from the comfort of his or her couch, even though, you know, legislators in 1993 with the casino authorization did not specifically intend to allow gaming in every nook and cranny of the state. Now, what this does with respect to what we saw over the weekend from Illinois is important. You know, it's essentially as if you've got an aging fighter who realizes that, hey, you know, I think I've got one more good fight in me, you know, to keep my heavyweight crown or whatever. But, you know, I've got to go and prepare for this. I've got to make sure that, you know, my abs are in shape for that gut punch that, you know, I could suffer. And I've got to make sure that I don't have that lantern jaw anymore. And essentially, we've built our fortifications up like that aging boxer. And we've tried to do what we can, knowing that there's going to be one more big fight. And that, yeah, they're going to land some punches on us, but we've got to be in the best shape that we can in order to kind of preserve ourselves for the long term so that we'll have a nice, long, healthy lifestyle and not necessarily be punch drunk, if that's still a politically correct term to use. And, you know, yes, Illinois, you know, took some big steps that are going to hurt us. You know, we don't know yet to what extent the Chicago casino will be a major factor with respect to Indiana. You know, you and I have had conversations over the last 5 years about whether a downtown or McCormick Place type casino really means anything for the city of Chicago with respect to, you know, Hammond, East Chicago, and Gary. I've always argued that this is the least critical element of an Illinois potential plan, and that a South Suburban casino or two would be a lot worse for the state of Indiana. And I still believe that way. And I know that we're still watching Illinois evaluate where that casino will go. But I'm getting more and more worried, Chris, because what I keep hearing is that Chicago casino may be not necessarily in the old post office building or somewhere in the Loop or at McCormick Place or, you know, the old Michael Reese complex by the railroad tracks there by the lake, but could be as far south, southeast as Lake Calumet and that Harborside development with all the landfills, the golf course, and you know, you'd have tremendous access from, you know, the Bishop Ford. You'd have Indiana people just a couple of miles away. You'd have the Illinois people who wouldn't have to go to the city of Chicago and deal with the issues of parking and driving in the city and going into the city at night for something that would have that a little bit more accessible to them, and they would have to pass that by on their way to at least East Chicago and Gary, if not Hammond as well, if they don't take the expensive routes on the Skyway and the toll road. So that bothers me that they're starting to talk about a Lake Calumet type site. But the South Suburban sites are also problematic, particularly, and I don't know the Illinois law well enough, I don't think anybody does yet, to know whether, you know, there might be the possibility of a couple of cities, you know, the Fort Heights and Country Club Hills perhaps say, hey, you know, let's team up on a casino and share the revenue, and we'll put one bigger casino, you know, in X spot as opposed to, you know, a dinky casino in your city and a dinky casino in our city and neither casino functioning particularly well. So, you know, there may be that option that would also further impinge upon Indiana. And then, like I said, I was very surprised to see that Danville stayed in there. You know, yes, Waukegan, yes, Rockford, yes, that winery place down in southwestern Indiana, okay, southwestern Illinois, okay. But I was surprised that they kept Danville in there after Terre Haute was included in the Indiana legislation. And that will cause a race to the state house, basically, in both states. Right. In Indiana, we have to pass a referendum for that Vigo County license to go into effect.
Yeah. In fact, they just
really
they just
kind
had
of start that process.
Yeah, they just had a public forum the other night in Terre Haute, and then didn't get 100% approval of it. There are people that are concerned about it. You know, the pros and the cons both to setting up the new casino there too. So there, yeah, there's a lot more they have to deal with down there,
yeah.
Even.
Yeah, and you know, you saw 20 something years ago when for example Porter County went and had its referendum that things went swimmingly in the larger cities, you know, Valparaiso and Portage and I think even in Porter itself, mm-hmm. the town of Porter, people were overwhelmingly for a vote. But then when she started to get out into the rural areas, the rural voters were almost twice as adamant about not having one, and they never were able to pass a referendum there. And you know, this is a countywide referendum in Vigo County. And it looks like if they hold it in November, you know, they're going to have a ballot where the only issue on the non-urban ballot, you know, outside of what basically I guess Terre Haute and West Terre Haute, you know, is going to be this casino question. And they're going to have vote centers and stuff like that. So there's going to be an easier opportunity for voters to turn out from the rural areas than they might have been. 20 something years ago, if they did the same kind of thing. So it's going to be interesting.
Yeah, it sounds like it could very well be, at least now, it could be a repeat of what happened in Porter County with the same type of dynamics. You're talking about the urban versus the rural. And there is, in this case, there's a lot more rural in some places in Vigo County than there are the urban people, except, you know, right there immediately around Terre Haute and West Terre Haute. West Terre Haute's not very big anyway. So, yeah.
No, it's not. To a certain extent, a little bit more industrial. But one big difference is that this was an organic effort from the people of Terre Haute, essentially, at least this time around. It may not have been 2 years ago, but this time around it was. And that's different than, we're one of seven counties that's potentially eligible for it if we pass a referendum. So, you know, that there was really some organic support, a groundswell of support from the grassroots there, and that's a big and important difference for Terre Haute.
Do you get the impression, since you had a chance to watch all this take place in the General Assembly this past session, as the discussions were going on, not only in where this other casino, that is to say the Terre Haute Casino, would be doing, or where it would be going, but what would be going on to do something to get the Gary Casino better established? As you mentioned, the issue of gaming in Illinois wasn't a question as much as it is now that we know that they're going to push very hard, apparently, for some type of Chicago area, you know, when we don't know how close to Chicago that casino might be. Do you think we're going to maybe still have some problems here, or are we? I guess you mentioned before it's just about being prepared. I suppose you think we're properly prepared here in Northwest Indiana for what we might face across the state line.
We're probably as best prepared as we could be.
Yeah.
We've done things for the operators. We've done things for the communities. And we've done things for the owners. And that's about all you can do in a situation like this. Now, if you're asking whether legislators really believe that Illinois would act this time, I think that the answer is no. I don't think that they felt that there was any more impetus for doing something in Springfield this time around than there had been in the last several years. Gosh, I was up in Chicago on Saturday, and a relative asked me, well, are they... You know, they just passed gaming in the House. Are they going to pass it in the Senate? It's not. I don't think. There's no way. You know, they aren't going to do that. And it was just very surprising on a number of fronts to see what Governor Pritzker was able to accomplish with the Democratic majority there that hadn't been done before and you know, hadn't even been done when Governor Quinn had a Democratic majority. So it's just very interesting to see how this all kind of came together. And I don't know that anybody there really knew what was included in some of this stuff, particularly when you get to the nuances of the sports wagering in Illinois.
Yeah.
What was really included in there, you know, on the final weekend's legislation, but they just felt that, hey, you know, this is going to give us a whole bunch of money and we're going to pass this thing. Now, that's the next interesting question, and that's a question that really needs to be posed to, you know, perhaps somebody like Tom Swoik with the Illinois Casino Association, and that's, you know, whether this is really going to actually be implemented, and we'll see the light of day in terms of actual practice. There's some questions as to whether if this is something that's practical, that the companies are going to be willing to pay X amount for licenses for sports wagering, that they will be able to find X amount of potential partners for this, and that this is going to be, you know, implemented in, you know, Soldier Field and Allstate Arena and places like that.
Well, it sounds like a lot more to come, of course, from across the state line. And with everything now just happening so quickly and so decisively, which is just, as you mentioned, it's taken everybody aback now. And apparently what's going to happen in Illinois as far as gaming is concerned, we'll have to watch very closely over here in Northwest Indiana to be sure. And we'll leave it there for another conversation, and hopefully that you'll get your voice back more. And you've given us yeoman work today on a very, very difficult subject here, to be sure.
Sure. And one more point, and that goes to what I was just finishing up there, and that's that, you know, when you look at what Indiana did what they did to just kind of position the industry, position the state, keep things going, and understand that the casino industry is an industry like any other business. I think Illinois may have approached it in a different way that may not serve them in the longer run, and that's they were just looking for money, particularly some upfront money from those licenses. And I think that the way that they ended up structuring their entire system there going forward is not reflective of any kind of long-term strategy, but rather that short-term money grab. And I don't know that will serve them well.
Well, maybe we over here in Indiana were wise to begin with here in trying to properly plan for the future. And the folks in Illinois are still basically one step behind us. Even though they'd like to be ahead, they're still only one step behind us, to be sure. So, well, Ed Feigenbaum, thank you very much for spending time with us to going over this. We'll have you back again. We'll talk about whatever the latest that comes out from Illinois and the other gaming issues here in Indiana are concerned. We'll be back in touch to have another conversation. Thanks very much today.
We will look forward to it. Appreciate you having me on, Chris.
You're welcome. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Teacher pay and school funding were central issues for policymakers as they crafted the state spending plan earlier this year. But the unpredictable structure of funding support in the state can be challenging for schools. About one-third of Indiana school districts have asked their local communities for more funding through voter-approved tax increases, also known as referendum issues. And isn't Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay tells us, the support is vital for school districts that are facing some really big cuts.
The steel mills of northern Indiana inspired the River Forest Community School's mascot, the Ingots.
I wish I would have brought my Ingot shirt today.
And as high school senior Julian Wilson talks with a couple of his classmates, a clear theme emerges, school pride.
And being in this school has really made me feel that Ingot spirit, and I really wanted to just share that with people and really give them my point of view.
He's talking about the funding referendum voters recently passed for the district. He's one of a handful of students who spoke with local taxpayers to get more of them to say yes, and they did. Superintendent Steve Disney says without those dollars, a lot was at stake.
Teaching positions, the staff positions, to looking at, you know, transportation for extracurriculars.
River Forest and the rest of Lake County schools are gearing up for a financial challenge most public schools in Indiana have faced for nearly a decade, property tax caps. When the caps went into place, lawmakers gave Lake and St. Joseph counties a decade to adapt. So starting next year, Disney says River Forest will be cut off from collecting about another $600,000 in local funding.
What that means at River Forest, that increase of $600,000 loss would have amounted to our entire transportation program.
And there aren't enough state dollars coming in. Two main factors determine most state support: student enrollment and number of students in poverty. So some schools could see little or no increases, while others lose money. Combined with limits on property taxes, that leaves many public schools scrambling for cash.
We have become, I'm very honest to say, we have become a referendum state.
Denny Costerson, executive director of the Indiana Association of School Business Officials, says past funding changes mean some schools already have more money than others.
There are discrepancies in this state. There's some equity issues, meaning that some districts, because of whatever circumstances in the past, are in a better situation fiscally than others are.
Some districts rely on voters to pass referenda often, but not all communities can or want to. Franklin Community Schools, just outside of Indianapolis, proposed a referendum for the first time this year. The district built a new high school around the time tax caps started. Chief Financial Officer Jeff Mercer says voters would have probably rejected a referendum then.
There was a lot of consternation about the building of the high school. So for us, 10 years ago, doing a referendum was not an option.
Mercer says the district has lost out on more than $27 million in local funding with the caps in place, and state support isn't enough. He says the recently passed referendum will help close growing gaps for things like teacher pay between districts.
We had a teacher take a $21,000 pay increase to do the same job in a different district. That's a problem.
Because keeping teachers in class means stability for kids.
You know, we can all survive on less or more money, and if you don't like what you make, you can go somewhere else and survive it. Those kids have no choice. That's where they're at.
Lawmakers will study school funding this summer to figure out how best to target dollars to the most in-need schools, and they plan to study the effects of school referenda on teacher pay. In the meantime, schools have to rely on their communities to keep classrooms open or have fewer of them. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
Foster youth in Indiana less likely than other students to get a quality education. That's based on the very first report that's come out about the young people who are in Indiana's foster care system. A state law that was enacted in 2018 has called for this annual report that was turned over to the State Department of Education. And Indiana Connected by 25, which is now known as Foster Success, got a copy of it. And Foster Success CEO Brent Kent was with us to talk more about it.
It's the legislation that actually Indiana Connected by 25 led last session. As you stated earlier, we work with foster youth as they're aging out of care, or as if they've already aged out of care, and our goal is to help them transition to adulthood on their own successfully. And we want to make sure that by age 25 that they're thriving, they're housed, they're employed, and they're successful adults. But one of the biggest barriers to their success is the lack of a quality K-12 education. And it's a lot of factors that go into this. Trauma, changing schools. On average, they'll change high schools 3 or 4 times. Their transcripts often don't follow them, so they're taking the same classes over again or out of sequence. But by and large, we have thousands of children in the state's own custody. And before this report, the state had no idea how they were doing in school, even though the state was making many education decisions on their behalf.
From the report that's come out here, you've had a chance to look over the data since it's been out for a few weeks. What have you found and some of the alarming facts that are in the report?
Mm-hmm. Well, we knew the data wouldn't be good, but we weren't prepared for how bad it is. Some of the key highlights is that only 64% of these young people are graduating high school, and about 21% of those graduate with a waiver that's waiving the graduation requirements to let them graduate. Mm-hmm. And what we know from national studies and a study of foster children in the Midwest, that 1 in 5 of these young people will be homeless within 2 years of leaving the state's care. 50% are unemployed at age 24, and only 3% ever obtain a college degree. And when you're looking at this data, it's no wonder. We see that foster children in our K-12 schools are disproportionately suspended and expelled, and there are massive achievement gaps on state assessments. Nowhere is this disparity greater than for Black students in foster care. We already know that foster care has a disproportionate negative effect on Black children and Black families. For example, Black children make up about 10% of the overall child population in Indiana, but about a quarter of the state's child welfare system. And what we see in this report is that our Black children are expelled at nearly 4 times the rate of their peers. And on statewide assessments, they're passing the 10th grade math I-STEP, for example, at a rate of 3.2%. So this report shows us 2 things. One, children in foster care are being denied the same educational opportunities as their peers because of their experience in foster care. And 2, the state is not doing enough to support their educational and lifetime success.
Are you finding from the data that you got from the report that you mentioned about the achievement that these young people are not necessarily getting because of their situation being in foster care? How do they seem to stand on the ISTEP exams overall?
I don't have that data right in front of me, Chris. It is in the report, and it shows just a massive disparity between students in foster care and their peers.
Mm-hmm. I know that you have a number of supporters, of course, not only for Indiana Connected by 25 in the General Assembly, but I guess you have a number of supporters that, as a result, have helped you, I guess, in the effort to get the bill passed last year, last session, to be sure, and probably in turn they're looking at this data and they're showing their concerns as well.
That's right. Chris, we are a very small nonprofit organization. We work all over the state to do the best we can with the little resources we have. We're not an organization with a big budget for advocacy or legislative efforts, so we relied on partnerships with other nonprofits. We relied on former foster youth advocates and our donors to last year come with us to the State House and push this legislation. It was a bit of a David and Goliath story, but this was a necessary first step, getting this data. Without the data, we can't make decisions or a strategic plan around how to improve these outcomes.
Mm-hmm. I also know, too, that your organization is very interested in making sure that there's a tax credit program that will give nonprofits an opportunity to be able to show their support that maybe that hadn't been out there before. Is this right?
That's right. A lot of people don't realize Indiana is ground zero in a national child welfare crisis. Mm-hmm. We've had the highest increase in the number of children entering foster care. We have more children in the state's custody than any surrounding state, even states with two times our population. So what we're asking for is in the state budget, the legislature create a tax credit program. This would benefit nonprofits providing family preservation services and support to foster children so they can quickly respond to this crisis and scale up solutions and hopefully finally put an end to what is now a humanitarian disaster.
Do you know if there's any support right now in this current legislative session, or are you going to have to aim for the 2020 General Assembly session to get the plan together to get the tax credit program up before a vote?
Well, we are optimistic that it can happen this legislative session, mm-hmm. but I think the legislature needs to hear from more of the public. Like I said, we are doing our best, but we are not a legislative lobbying organization. We're a nonprofit providing services directly to youth in the field around the state, but they need to hear from more of the public, but we are optimistic we can make this happen this year.
Foster Success CEO Brent Kent has a conversation on Regionally Speaking not long before the General Assembly ended. In 2018, there were 118 reports of drownings on the Great Lakes, making it the deadliest year since the Great Lakes Surf Rescue Project began tracking drownings back in 2010. It could all be avoided by just some common sense rules when in the water. And we had this conversation with Dave Benjamin, who's the co-founder of the project, about it. He offers up first some bits of advice, and he also encourages a bit more public education, particularly beginning in the schools.
I think part of it is going to be, the configuration of Lake Michigan. It's 307 miles from north to south, and we get the prevailing winds, which are coming from the north or northwest, which creates a lot of wave activity and dangerous currents on the south end of the Great Lakes. In addition to that, there's a high population that lives in the area from Chicago to northwest Indiana, southwest Michigan. And then with that, a lot of tourism, especially in the summertime, everyone wants to cool off and go to the beach. So it's just, a unique mix of high population and a location that can be dangerous, especially if you don't know what the hazards are. And if you don't know just the basics, that drowning is one of the leading causes of accidental death in the United States and the world. So most people don't know that. They might think, okay, we're going to the beach, it's like we're going to the park. But if you fall off the monkey bars, you might sprain an ankle. But if you get in trouble and water over your head, it may cost you your life.
When we get into these situations, is just a fact that people, like you mentioned before, they think it's like swimming in a swimming pool, although those could be dangerous too, but it's even worse when you've got that push of water coming out of the north, coming towards the not only the lakefront, but also, I guess, the beaches as well, too.
If somebody were to submerge in a pool, it's a contained body of water, and it's got high visibility or higher visibility than what you have in the Great Lakes.
Mm-hmm.
And so if somebody goes missing underwater in the Great Lakes. You know, it's a large body of water. It's not contained. There's currents that could, you know, drift the body in a, you know, different directions. In addition, there's very, very low visibility. And so, you know, if you don't have eyes on the water at all time, monitoring the people in the water to, you know, actually know what drowning really looks like versus the Hollywood version of it, and witnessing someone in distress and being able to get something to them that floats immediately, then it's a huge, huge problem. And, you know, what we want people to know is that with drowning, time is of the essence. If somebody is actively drowning, they're doing the signs of drowning, which is typically facing shore, mouth at water level, head tilted back, doing climbing the ladder motion. There's not a lot of waving, yelling, and splashing. If they're doing those drowning response signs, it's typically less than 60 seconds until final submersion.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So if you don't have eyes on the water, and if you can't spot that person who's subtly drowning, it's very subtle, you're gonna miss them. And then people also need to know is once that person submerges, at 2 minutes, if they're recovered and CPR and artificial respiration is properly performed, it's about a 94% survival rate. But at 10 minutes of submersion, that survival rate's only about 14%. So how fast can you get something to them that floats? How long would it take to, one, realize the person submerged, two, call 911, and then for 911 to pinpoint your location, to send dispatch, and for them to arrive? They're arriving past the 10-minute marks. So lifeguards really, really are the biggest factor in here. If we can have properly trained open water surf lifeguards who are monitoring the beach, know what to look for, and are, you know, physically trained to get out there and get flotation to that person. And then, you know, in the event that someone does submerge, being able to get to that last point of seeing at the water and then be able to do an underwater search and get them back up and on shore, you know, within a couple of minutes to get that CPR and artificial respiration going. It's very, very time sensitive, and people just aren't aware of that.
There are some great diagrams if you want to go to the Great Lakes Surf Rescue Project website and take a look at these. One is entitled, How Does Drowning Look, or What Does Drowning Look Like? And the other one is an interesting description of the steps that you need to follow if you find yourself out there or if you're with other people who find themselves in this situation. Check it out on the website. Let's go through them, if we will, here, Dave. And you've mentioned some of the points already here, and you talked about the Hollywood view of drowning. I guess you think about, of course, the trailer for the movie Jaws, with the person floundering in water, and of course the great white shark coming up behind them or underneath them, whatever. That's not the way the drowning really, really looks. Like, tell us about it.
We more relate it to like the old TV show Baywatch, mm-hmm. where, you know, every episode there's several rescues in the episode, and it would be a long traumatic event where someone's at the surface of the water for 2 to 5 minutes, you know, yelling, waving, splashing, a long traumatic event so that they can cut to a lifeguard in a tiny bathing suit running in slow motion with theme music to, you know, then get in the water and make the rescue in time for commercial break. Unfortunately, that image of drowning as a long traumatic visible event, you know, translated into beach signs, they would show, like, you know, danger drowning, where it's like somebody in chest deep water with their arms up in the air or waving their hands or yelling for help. And so we want people to know that drowning doesn't look like how drowning or how Hollywood has portrayed it, and that it's very, very subtle. That if somebody, you know, a distressed swimmer may have some ability to do some yelling or splashing, but they exhaust themselves pretty quick. And once their body goes vertical in the water, facing shore, mouth at water level, head tilted back, hyperventilating, you know, doing climbing the ladder motion with their hands are barely breaking the surface. I mean, it's dire. They need something. They need immediate assistance. Anything that floats, whether it's a life ring or a football or a volleyball or even a cooler, something that floats, they need it as soon as possible to interrupt the drowning process. Because once we, you know, as said before, it's very, very time sensitive. 2 minutes of submersion, it could be a full recovery. 10 minutes of submersion, it's likely a body recovery.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Dave Benjamin, who is the co-executive director of the Great Lakes Surf Rescue Project, about the dangers of swimming, or surfing for that matter, and not being aware of your surroundings. If you're in Lake Michigan, some tips to know if you find yourself or if you're with friends and find themselves in the situation of drowning, and how to save your life, as well as your friends that might be with you as well, too. One of the diagrams that Dave, I know, is listed on the website, and we've mentioned, you talked a little bit about some of the steps here. Flip, float, and follow. Tell us what that will designate and what, in turn, might help save your life if you follow that advice.
If you ever find yourself struggling in water over your head, what we advocate is that people flip, float, and follow. It's the stop, drop, and roll of water safety.
Mm-hmm.
And how it works is, you flip over on your back and you float. The emphasis is on floating. You float to keep your head above water. You float to calm yourself down from the fear and extreme panic of drowning. And you float to conserve your energy. And then you follow the safest path back to shore. So we want to, you know, really emphasize is the ability to float or to have something with you that floats, like a life jacket. Flotation is the key. If, you know, some people tell us, I can't float. We say, well, if you're in a drowning situation, do you want to live? Yes or no? If you want to live, you must stay at the surface of the water and continue breathing for as long as possible for either rescue to arrive or until you are able to self-rescue and get back to shallower water where you can stand. We get the most confusion or questions about follow. What does follow mean?
Mm-hmm.
And follow means follow the safest path out of the water. And then the next question is, what's the safest path? And unfortunately, every drowning is going to be unique to the body of water, the conditions of the water, other waves and dangerous currents, to the water temperature, as well as the person's physical swimming ability and swimming endurance. So that's a lot of factors. So we want people to know that when you go to the water, if you get in trouble, you may have to follow the safest path out of the water, making, you know, that judgment call, what's the safest path out of the water in a life and death situation. And it may not be very easy and may be overwhelming. So continue floating.
Mm-hmm.
Float as long as possible. Flotation is the key. We cannot emphasize that enough.
Now, you mentioned about the fact that follow whatever the next step is to be able to save your life is difficult. And you've seen enough of these rescues that have happened on Lake Michigan, people that have managed to survive drowning incidents there, too. Every single case is different. It's pretty unique. Are there any common things that you have discovered in looking at these cases on Lake Michigan in particular that have, probably people can maybe keep in the back of their minds that if the opportunity presents itself, they can use that as following through?
Always take something with you that floats, you know, and one thing we've seen is that it happens quite a bit is like people aren't aware of an offshore wind where the wind is blowing from land out to open water. Someone might get in a kayak or on a stand-up paddleboard or some other type of flotation device like a raft. And what happens is the flotation gets caught in the wind and starts blowing away from shore. And the further you get away from shore, the stronger the wind gets and the more turbulent the water gets and the colder the water gets. People often make a fatal mistake is, oh, my God, I'm floating away from shore and it's this kayak in the wind. So what I should do is get out of it and try and swim back. The big problem is now you're getting into cold water over your head and your swimming ability likely isn't going to be able to get you back to shore. So we always say always stay with the flotation device. Try and signal for help so that, you know, maybe somebody with a jet ski or a boat or first responders with a flotation, you know, craft can get to you to make the rescue. But ditching the flotation device, you know, is a fatal mistake. Always stay with flotation.
Yeah, that's a very, very wise choice to make here. How important do you feel and your colleagues there at the Great Lakes Surf Rescue Project feel about having some kind of regular training or at least some kind of instruction in schools away from the lake, at least let them know about these dangers, so this way they might be prepared when weather warms up and they go out swimming?
It is absolutely essential to have a water safety school curriculum in place, not just in the Great Lakes region, but really nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
Main reason why is because people go on vacation. Wherever they go on vacation, there's going to be some type of water. You go to a hotel, there's going to be an unguarded pool. You know, if you go to, you know, Pure Michigan, 1 in 5 jobs is related to water. Everywhere you go, there's water. There's inland lakes, there's streams, there's rivers. There's the Great Lakes, and you know, people really need to know what to do around water. And unfortunately, you know, we do two types of presentations. We do public presentations, and we do, you know, like, say, school presentations. A public presentation is a volunteer audience. A school presentation is a captive audience. Mm-hmm. You know, the kids are in school, and they're going to that presentation that day. We've noticed that, you know, when we have a public presentation, we might get one person that shows up, or 20 people that show up, or rare occasions, if we have a great organizer, we'll get 100 people that show up. And that's a very, very small attendance. Whereas if we go to a high school that has 2,000 students, we could see 2,000 students in the day. Now, when we have public presentations and we're inviting people to attend these public presentations, you know what the number one thing we hear?
What?
The number one thing we hear is that, I know how to swim. I don't have to worry about drowning. My kids know how to swim. They don't have to worry about drowning.
What bad advice could you give? That's not wise.
And the harsh reality is that two-thirds of all drowning victims, 66%, are good swimmers. Okay, so there's a disconnect there. And I often say to people in reply, hey, I know how to run, but I couldn't run a marathon right now if my life depended on it. A drowning accident is a marathon for your life. It's not about how fast you can get out of the water. It's how long you can stay at the surface of the water until you can, you know, reach shore or rescue to arrive. And so we got to make that connection. And unfortunately, you know, one-on-one conversations is a very small way to make that connection. If we can get into schools and we can educate students the way that we educate for fire drills, tornado drills, school shooter drills, even earthquake drills. Schools in Illinois and Indiana have earthquake drills. Do you remember how bad the last earthquake was in Indiana? Because I don't remember in my lifetime if there's been a fatal earthquake.
Not around here. We've had ones that people have noticed, but that's only it, basically.
Right. And the big picture is, in my almost 50 years of lifetime, I can't remember a fatal earthquake in Indiana. But on average, in the United States, 10 people per day will die drowning. So there's a huge disconnect for the need for earthquake drills in schools versus the need for water safety in schools. And don't get me wrong, I'm not opposed to earthquake drills in schools. I'm simply saying we need to elevate water safety to the realm of other safety programs like fire drills, tornado drills, school shooter drills, and earthquake drills. Because the big picture drowning is that it's likely that more school-age children will die drowning each year than die in fires, tornadoes, school shooters, and earthquakes combined. So it's time to wake up, America, and get water safety in schools.
Dave Benjamin, who is the co-founder of the Indiana Great Lakes Surf Rescue Project on Regionally Speaking back in 2017. But the issue of drowning on Lake Michigan is just as serious and just as important. You've heard the announcements that we've aired here on Lakeshore Public Radio recently, and you might have been intrigued by why we're putting them out there. They're all part of a campaign, which is we're entitling the 300 Campaign, and we have in studio to talk more about the creation of this campaign and the benefits that will come from it. We're talking with Wendy Berber, she's the Vice President of Development, and Tom Maloney, our Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Radio. And thank you both for joining us here on the program today.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Chris.
Well, I'll let you decide who wants to start. Whoever created or whatever did the creation of this 300 campaign get involved in. And it's mm-hmm. not just ours. I guess others around the country have taken a look at this and are taking advantage of this program, too.
Well,
I guess you're going first, Wendy. That's how it works.
I looked at you, so I guess maybe that's a cue.
The LPR 300 campaign is Lakeshore Public Radio 300. It's our goal for signing up 300 new sustaining members. Sustaining members at $10 per month, automatically renewable. And what that 300 represents is about $36,000 over the course of 12 months. Mm-hmm. So $36,000 will help to cover a shortfall that in our federal funding mm-hmm. of about $30,000. It also represents about half the cost of our programming. Just programming alone costs about $64,000 per year to fund. And that's not including people, that's not including power, that's not including all the equipment that needs to be maintained. That's just programming alone. Mm-hmm. So we are truly a community-funded organization, nonprofit broadcaster. And so it's really the basis for it. We will have the end of our fiscal year ends on September 30th. So that's our target date as far as signing up that those 300 new members. Hopefully we'll have more. We'd love to surpass that number, and we can only do that with the support of the community.
When you talk about the dwindling amount of federal funds that have come in our case here, we've got the shortfall here. Can you go into a little bit more as to what happened as far as Lakeshore Public Radio's instance, as to why there were changes? Apparently, it must have been made in Washington, D.C., that are going to mean less federal funds. We don't get a lot of federal funds anyway, we know, or right. state money for that matter, too. Mm-hmm. But there is some that comes in for various reasons. And why are we seeing less of it now than in the past?
So, when people hear about funding for public broadcasting through the federal government, oftentimes they're thinking that, you know, it's President Bush and President Clinton and Bush again, and it's Obama and it's Trump cutting checks. Well, the way it works is the federal government gives money to the CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You see the logos on our sister station, Lakeshore PBS, all the time after all of the different shows. So the Corporation for Public Broadcasting sets up this formula. And with this formula, they determine how many stations – well, not how many stations, but what stations get what. So TV stations generally get a lot more money than radio stations. TV costs a lot more money to operate. Our annual TV operations budget, I think, is well north of $3 million. Correct me if I'm wrong, Wendy. It might be five, about three. Our radio operations budget for the year is about $330,000. It is 10 times less – than the television side of things. So you can imagine through federal funding through the CPB, we should probably get about 10 times less than what we get on the television side. It's pretty close. So we get about $100,000 a year from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting decides that amount based on the amount of revenue you generate at your station. So the big stations generate a lot of revenue. Think of our partners WFYI in Indianapolis or other big public broadcasting stations here in the Midwest. They're getting a lot of money. Small stations don't get a lot of money. So the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, in order to essentially get the most bang for their buck, decided that they would start pulling back funding from small stations in order to help support the bigger stations to help them grow bigger and larger and stronger. And it's one of those things where the Corporation for Public Broadcasting essentially wanted to zero out all of the federal funding for us, Lakeshore Public Radio, and about a dozen other stations across the country in all different markets, all different locations. And we're using this opportunity now for the Lakeshore 300 campaign to inform people about funding for public broadcasting. Now, we get a lot of money – we get a lot of money from the state through IPBS and our partnership there with the 14 other stations across the state in both TV and radio. And we get a lot of funding as well from underwriters and from local businesses in Northwest Indiana. But by and large, during a typical pledge drive, you always hear that pitch. You know, it is, you know, you, the listener, are the biggest slice of that pie. And that's true. And that's why we're coming to you to make up that lost ground, that lost funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to ensure that we are going to be able to continue to bring you the quality content and programming that you've come to expect. So Wendy mentioned September 30th. That is the end of our fiscal year. October 1 is normally when, you know, the new year rolls over. I will say this. I'm going to go on record, so make sure we save the tape, that starting September 30th, we will be bringing to you a live statewide show from Indianapolis in partnership with Indiana Public Broadcasting News. Now, we're still deciding on a name, and I can't release the name of the host for the program yet either, but despite that cutback in federal funding at the statewide level and at the local level, we're really working on making sure that we're still able to give you the most quality content, the most quality mm-hmm. programming that we can bring you on a daily, weekly, monthly, yearly basis. And it's all made possible, again, because of that continued support at the local level from our listeners. And so that means there are some changes afoot when it comes to our broadcast schedule starting September 30th and in order to add this new live program to our lineup. But this also means some other things might happen. And these are things we never want to do, but I always have to do. It's part of my job and my duties is to assess every single program that we run on the station, whether it's a weekend program, an evening program, a daily program. It's an opportunity to figure out, are we doing the most goodwill with the dollars that we get from our members? And the Lakeshore 300 campaign, the LPR 300 campaign, which, by the way, you can text to 44321.
Hint, hint.
Yes, is an opportunity for you to help support the programming that you love. And so theoretically, if we don't hit our goal or we don't come close, I have to do the hard job of looking at the programs and looking at the shows that we air and figuring out when he talks about the $64,000 program budget, I have to reduce that program budget. Mm-hmm. That's just, you know, that's the facts of the matter. And we might be a nonprofit, we're local public radio, but we still have to pay bills and we still have to make sure that you know, our books at the end of the year, fiscal year, I should note, are even and that we're not underwater, that we're not finishing in the red. So this is really, it's an opportunity for Northwest Indiana to help support all of the programming that they love, all of the news, all of the information, all of the relevant content that Northwest Indiana relies on every day. That's what this 300 campaign is for. It's for you, the listeners, to help support your local public radio station. And I'm going to throw a couple of other numbers out that Wendy had had put together. So we're at about $64,000 a year for our annual operations for programming. Per day, it breaks down to about $175 a day. How many minutes in a year? Well, Chris, I'm glad you asked. There's 525,600. So what does that all mean? 12 cents a minute.
Yeah.
Every minute of programming that you hear on Lakeshore Public Radio costs us about 12 cents. Mm-hmm. And so this helps alleviate that because like every other business, we have bills to pay. We don't run these programs for free, and we're not an NPR member affiliate for free or an American Public Media affiliate for free. So when you get Marketplace and Marketplace Tech and Morning Edition and ATC, when you get all of the national programming, all the local news and information, the stuff from IPBS, Indiana Public Broadcasting News, it all costs money. And so we have to make sure that we are still in good standing with all of those organizations as well. That's the long story. This is what happens when you give a radio guy a microphone.
That's right. Well, we only have a little time left here. I guess in general, this is not only about keeping programs on the air and helping keep the funding alive. It's sustainability. It's the important point here that we want to be sure that the Lakeshore Public Radio is around for a long time. And the only way we can do that is by getting everybody in the community who listens to Lakeshore Public Radio and is not already a sustaining member to become a sustaining member of Lakeshore Public Radio. And it's so simple. There are two avenues I know for sure that in the announcements we talk about. And Wendy, I'll let you close things out by giving us what those two avenues of showing your support through the 300 campaign are.
Right. Very easily get your cell phone out and you can text LPR 300 to 44321. Mm-hmm. And it's as easy as that. You enter in, yes, I want to make a contribution, a monthly contribution of $10 or more a month, and you are good to go. You can also go to our website at lakeshorepublicradio.org /give, and that information is there as well. So there's a donor page there set up. You can even look at that to see where we're at, how we are acquiring our 300 members. Mm-hmm. We're starting out slow. We want to get some boosts out there, so I hope that our listeners are getting their cell phones out right now and making that pledge of support.
That's Wendy Burbridge, who's our Vice President for Development, along with Tom Maloney, who's our Vice President for Radio Operations, talking about the 300 campaign that's underway here at Lakeshore Public Radio. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow, it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday.